JSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
I'm Jesse Brown, and just when you thought things were going to calm down, looks like we're going to have to lead the global opposition to Trumpism.
Clearly, that's one strategy, and I personally think it's being pretty clearly demonstrated that it's the correct strategy, which is go f*** yourself.
Wait for that.
Mark Carney, who ran on an anti-Trump platform. You take that, Trump. That's what happens when you mess with a country whose national pastime is bar fight on ice.
He's trying to break us so that America can own us. That will never, ever happen.
Come at me, bro. Let me introduce you to my two friends, Quiet and Reasonable. Come on.
That's pretty good, but let's look beyond American late night TV for proof of our existence and what it means on the global stage. Here's Reuters reporting Carney aims for global leadership role against Trump. Over in France, France 24 reporting that in choosing Carney, Canada may be answering the question, who will go head to head against Donald Trump? Al Jazeera reporting that Carney's win is a rebuke of Trump's trade war. And the BBC going further than anyone else, describing Mark Carney as a leader of a, quote, G7 fight back against Trump. I guess the idea with all of these global headlines about Canada is that in electing Carney, we did not only buck the global trend towards angry, anti-woke populism, but that we made a specific and deliberate choice to take Trump on, to not bend the knee, to not kiss the ring. And even more than that, that with Mark Carney in charge, Canada is now gearing up to lead some coalition of the willing in a coming face-off with an increasingly hostile and aggressive United States. Huh. Let's test that premise. Is Canada now leading an international rebel alliance? I mean, how would we even do that? Do we have the muscle for that? Are we internally coherent enough to do something like that? Almost seems like a ridiculous idea to entertain. So it makes a lot of sense for me to bring in the ridiculously entertaining writer, Stephen Marsh, my friend, to discuss it. Stephen is the author of The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future. It's an interesting book, kind of like speculative journalism, in which, here's the blurb, a celebrated journalist takes a fiercely divided America and imagines five chilling scenarios that lead to its collapse. He's also the author of the book On Writing and Failure, and he's going to join me here in our Toronto studio in a moment. Wait for it. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Jesse. How you doing?
I'm good. Why are you tired?
Got up at 4, didn't have a nap. I've been writing my ass off. There's just like so much.
Canada?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm in the American pessimism business. The last time I remember it being like this was during the Rob Ford years.
Yeah.
Where it's like the freelancer tap is just on. During the Rob Ford years, I remember like German magazines calling me up saying, can you write about it?
Yeah.
At $3 a word. And it's sort of the same now.
What is the world's interest in Canada right now?
We're the resistance, man. But also, we're the lens. We're the lens by which this is going to be seen. The world is going to see it. We understand this situation in America much better. I think Canada's on the front, and I think the chances of some kind of resistance to Donald Trump in some kind of middle power fusion will probably be led by Canada. Or it will heavily involve Canada. Canada will be in the middle of that very actively.
It's hard to think of like Mark Carney as the leader of the resistance.
Why?
Because he's all of the things Pierre Poilievre, Davos, globalist, like he's part of like the establishment.
But it's resistance to populism.
Uh-huh.
Right. It's resistance to authoritarianism. It's resistance for the global rules-based order, of which he is the ultimate expression. He's like the global rules-based order coalesced into a human being and started walking around.
And poured into a suit.
Yeah. He was born in Fort Smith. So how he got from Fort Smith to running the Bank of England is actually one of the craziest stories that you can imagine. But yeah, he's like the purest expression of international cooperation and the rules-based order that you can have.
You know what I admire about you, if nothing else, is how confident you sound at all times, regardless of whether or not you know what you're talking about.
This stuff I do know what I'm talking about. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you read The Next Civil War. Was I right? Did I know what I was talking about?
Well, let me think about that.
What, did you read my stuff about AI? Was I right?
I remember you sitting in this studio or talking to me when I sat in the studio about the coming 10 years of conservative rule in Canada.
You, you're the one who pitched that show, right?
Oh.
Yeah.
I spoke very confidently.
Yeah.
And I was wrong.
Well, you know, events changed it. At that point, the model only went one direction.
Mm-hmm.
The unimaginable happened. Now, that's why you should never really make predictions. But
I learned my lesson,
know
what lane you're in. I'm about what happened like 2 days ago, yesterday, maybe today, but not tomorrow.
I mean, there's a reason why it's a mug's game to make predictions. Yeah. Even with, like in the next Civil War, that's why I say explicitly, it's not predictions, it's just modeling, right? And models are always wrong. But some of them are interesting.
So our model was that populism was steamrolling the globe and that, like, puny little Canada is not going to be able to resist this. We're going to get swept into the same trends that, like, why would we think we were special?
Well, I think that what we were talking about really was that the hatred of identity politics, the housing crisis, and the immigration screw-up were such potent forces that the liberals were just going to be destroyed by them. And I'm not sure that that's entirely still wrong. It's just that another element has been added, and there was only one reaction that the Canadian people had, right?
This is the other thing I admire. And I mean, when I say I admire it, I mean it in a completely sincere way of like, oh, I wish I could do it as well as he does. To snatch victory from the jaws of defeat, integrate new information, and still emerge correct and confident.
Well, no. I'm not saying I was correct. Well, I don't really make predictions, right? We did that show with an assumption. Right, as a framework for understanding where we were going.
Where we sat at the time, it would be historically unprecedented for the level of animosity towards the government, which is reflected in the 20-25% lead that the Conservatives had, widespread hatred of Trudeau and his government on the streets of this country, and I think a pretty astute read on like the cultural mood, which was one of outrage and abhorrence towards everything from little tent encampments to rising crime rates to being told what to say and what not to say at a time when our future prospects and our productivity and our quality of living had decoupled from America and we were looking like we were heading to be like the next Argentina
something. I think the key...
And we were right that for that not to mean a conservative victory would be a unprecedented historical anomaly, which then happened.
See, that's my point. And also, I think it's very important not to get misinformed by the result that just happened. You know, Fabius, the Roman general, said results are the teachers of fools, right?
Yeah, but you know Fabius.
Well, he did beat Hannibal and keep the Roman Empire intact, or the Republic intact. You know, the key thing to remember about this election is that young people voted for conservatives by significant majority.
Yeah.
All of the problems that Poilievre was riding are still there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I hope, but I do not believe that the Liberal Party will discover that it was wrong about all these things and change its practices. I think that this election will probably lead to more arrogance and them thinking they were right about everything and just showed everyone, which will lead to disaster for them.
I am interested in the phone calls that you're receiving and the emails from editors of international press saying, give us the report from Canada because we see you as the resistance. We have the world's attention as an exemplar of how to push back. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think the Carney strategy has become one approach to Trump. Not everyone is picking it, but clearly that's one strategy. And I personally think it's being pretty clearly demonstrated that it's the correct strategy, which is go yourself. I mean, to put it in the crudest possible terms, but like, and also to prepare for American chaos, like, do not expect things to go back to normal, right? And don't expect, like, suddenly America's going to come to its senses. That time has passed. And Canada, I think, understands that much better than people in Germany or people in England or people in Japan and Korea.
So that's an interesting contradiction between why we were told people voted for Carney and what Carney was actually saying. In that what we heard constantly was Canada is going to pick the guy who can stand up to Trump, negotiate with Trump, get the best deal from Trump. And Carney, I mean, he wasn't contradicting that, but he was saying the relationship is over. Those are kind of different things, right?
No, no. I think they're very much the same thing.
How so?
I mean, the Japanese have literally just gone home from America because they went and tried to make a deal, right? And they got to Washington and basically what the people they met with said was, dazzle us. And they're like, what are you talking about? What do you want from us? And there was no answer from what they want. So you're not talking with people that you can negotiate with, right? And I think there's something very interesting that has happened is that everyone tries to talk about how to strategize around Trump. Like, what is the strategy? What's his plan? Then how can we counter this plan? There's no plan, right? There's just chaos. And so what Carney understands is that the deal that needs to be made is we will negotiate with them if they ever come to us with something other than pure malice. But we need to start disentangling from the United States as quickly as possible, economically, politically, socially, militarily, culturally. That is a very big order. It is a very hard thing to actually do. But that is what he ran on. And that's what resonated. And that's why he won. And, you know, I actually don't think it was that different from what Pauly ever said either, but
it's not,
it's not that different. I think we don't really have a choice. Like, I think everyone who knows what's going on basically knows that we need to disentangle from the United States.
Yeah. The last thing you said bears a little bit of unpacking. That's what he ran on, and that's what resonated and what he was voted in for. I think that there was, I don't know, it's hard to distinguish what the media was telling us from what people actually felt in their souls.
Well, I just mean him saying the relationship is over.
What I'm saying is that we all proceeded throughout this last campaign under the assumption that there was a meaningful spectrum of difference between what one prime minister might be able to extract from America, from Donald Trump, versus the other. That there was a negotiation that is not predetermined, that is somehow within our control. And I question that premise from the start, that one of these guys is going to be better at getting stuff from Trump than the other.
But Jesse, there is no getting anything from this. See, to me, what the choice was is when the crisis comes, like when the fiscal crisis comes in the United States and they have a proper debt crisis like in Argentina and the American dollar starts to devalue and the bond market starts to react and they pass this $5 trillion tax cut while their deficit spending is larger than their military budget and things really, you know, really start to get out. Who is better of getting us out of that situation? And I think that's why people voted for Carney, because the 2008 crisis, the Brexit crisis, which he managed to, you know, he managed to get England out of that without a recession, right? Which is astonishing. And that to me is where his expertise lies. America's driving the bus over the cliff. Who is better to get us to jump out? Who is going to help us jump out best? I don't think between Poilievre and Carney, there was any question of whether we need to jump. That to me was very clear from both sides, actually.
Yeah, you're giving the voter a lot of credit. And maybe
it clarifies the mind when people are talking about annexing your country. It really does.
Yeah, maybe I could buy that on like a horse sense level, not to be insulting to people. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that it's like broken down to the extent that you just broke it down. But I do feel like, and this may be where the media oversimplified things, I think that people made a gut level decision about, I don't know what the coming next.
Yeah.
And maybe none of us do. So it's not about who's going to stand up to Trump in a negotiation sense. It's about when the hits the fan, which of these two guys do I think, and I've only really got an option between two of them, which of these guys is going to be more competent at dealing with an unprecedented catastrophe of a largely economic nature.
And that's not theoretical. Like, that's coming.
Uh-huh.
Right? Like, it's not, like, it's on its way. Right? And I mean, I think,
well, now you're in the prediction business.
Well, Paul Wells, the second rule, I think really applies here, which is that politician who promises the most boredom wins. Right. That's his second law of is I've got it wrong.
I think you got it wrong.
It's
the,
close
the,
to
the
that,
one though. Who runs for all right, here they are. For any given situation, Canadian politics will tend towards the least exciting possible outcome.
That's the one I'm thinking of.
And I confirmed with Wells as soon as Carney snagged the leadership, I said there is no unexciting outcome in this election. Everything, this is uncommonly exciting for Canada. And he goes, yes, but given this situation, a Carney victory is the least exciting possible outcome. And lo and behold, that's the one. Here's the issue with Carney as the leader of the resistance, to my thinking.
Uh-huh.
He represents rules-based order, globalized economies in a world that no longer exists, by his own description.
Well, yeah.
So there's no going back.
No, but I mean, I think...
does he represent, and I wonder...
Well, that's true of all of us. I mean, I think we're all about to live in a very different Canada.
But isn't the choice of Carney and the choice of the Liberal Party, on an optics level, on a vibe level, I felt like a lot of his success was, here comes a guy who's sort of offering us, don't worry, Canada, everything can be the way that it was. You've got,
No.
We flirted with somebody who was a little bit of razzle-dazzle.
But he said literally the opposite. He said literally everything has changed. There's no going back.
Yeah, I don't know if people heard that part.
The relationship is over was the message of his campaign. Right. So the question that you really should be asking.
It's back to the natural governing party of Canada with the same cast of characters,
yeah.
with the same stern dad who's like a slight variation on a Harper. Like, this is what Canada always reverts to.
Well, this
are
is
we
the...
actually breaking off into some bold new future, or are we just reverting to like kind of a dumb hope that we can kind of go back to the way things were?
This is actually the question that is going to face this country for the next 4 years, if not a little longer. So I think that Carney is expressly stated that we need a complete reevaluation of national priorities, and the threat from the United States requires massive reevaluation of not only our economic structures, but our military structures. I mean, the fact that we're no longer Robin to America's Batman, and that Batman has certainly turned into the Joker, right, means that we have to get our act together in a way that we never, ever have had to do,
mm-hmm.
right? We were part of the American empire and the global order, NATO, WTO, Francophonie, the Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we saw our power, as in a node in these international arrangements, right? And before that, the British Empire. The empires are gone and we're alone. And we are going to need national institutions, the likes of which we have never had, right? You know, I've been interviewing people from Finland and Sweden about what it's like to live next to a psychotic country that, you know, you can't trust and is threatening to annex you. You know, they have whole society defenses. They have conscription, but also constant engagement with the population about external threats, right? We may well have to have something like this. Here is the question. And it is really the question for the country. It's actually the question you asked. Are we going to be able to understand that we need to make that much change? And are we going to be able to overcome our own innate desire just to lead a peaceful, quiet life that with nothing grand about it, and overcome the complacency that is going to absolutely infest our bureaucracies, military, cultural, social, or political? And the problem that I see is that because this is such an antique liberal government, because it's like the same people have been around forever, the impetus for inertia and complacency is just going to be vast. It's just going to be, it's going to be really hard to overcome those forces. You can ask the Ukrainians, like, you know, the trains from Mariupol were half empty the day before the Russians invaded. They really didn't think it was coming, right? They just really believed that it was not possible. And so they were, you know, not as prepared as they could have been. I think we should be absolutely in a preparatory mode and refashioning our political and certainly our foreign policy structures completely. Can a government that is going to feel validated for its 10 years of failure do that? I don't know the answer to that.
If you're going to ask the questions instead of me and answer them, I can just go get a sandwich.
Well, great. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. Actually, could you get me one? Like, just I just need a soda.
Yeah, no. We can't do that. No.
Why?
After a national history that has always been the little, like, fish that swims beside the shark,
yeah,
picking up whatever krill drops out of its mouth and like cleaning its hole. Like, no, we cannot suddenly reimagine ourselves with a forced conscription. You hit 18 and you go and do military service to fend off a horde of American. And can we do so under the leadership of the Liberal Party of Canada?
I don't think you should be so dismissive. I think the very turn of this election, like, this is an insane election. Right. This was an election fought on one question, which spurred such intense feelings that, it's totally unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
We're in unprecedented times. And, you know, I would also say...
So you are one of the lunatics who's, like, envisioning militias of Canadians protecting the border.
Militias? No. I do think we absolutely need to think about something like national service. I think there's lots of reasons for it. I think the increasing number of natural disasters is one reason for it. I think absolutely that should be on the table. I also think becoming a nuclear power should be on the table. And I think...
I like dumb thought experiments, so I've had versions
that's
of this conversation.
Not, I don't think, I think if you ask Ukrainians whether this is a thought experiment, they don't think it's a thought experiment.
Yeah, but we're not.
Why not?
Is that us?
Listen, we actually can make drastic changes when we feel threatened. And there is actually a collective spirit in this country that is pronounced, is real. Before everyone stopped buying American and stopped vacationing in America, would you have said people are going to give up their trips to Vegas? You would have said, who are you kidding?
So my, I don't know, at this point, decade-long critique of Canadian nationalism as shallow and facile, this patriotism that has more to do with, I don't know, Tim Hortons and hockey, like a game that fewer and fewer Canadians play, like just a bunch of very empty symbols. I've had to seriously rethink that when the threat of annexation came up and we have not heard any kind of meaningful embrace of that threat. What we've heard is from, like I said it earlier on the show, what we've seen instead is from Quebec separatism to the oil sands to the West Coast, f*** off America.
Yeah.
F*** off.
No, I mean, I just think you have to be careful.
We don't want to be Americans.
You have to be careful about cynicism. Cynicism sounds accurate, but it often isn't.
Yeah.
Right?
No, you know what? Cynicism is its own sentimentality.
Exactly.
You know?
No, that's true. And, like, I think we may not be able to afford that kind of cynicism anymore because we're not going to be American. Like, there's no interest in that whatsoever. So then we have to ask ourselves, what steps do we take? Now, here's the other thing. You know I have my criticisms of Canadian culture and so on, right? And I tend to agree with you. There's going to be a lot of inertia. And there's going to be a lot of complacency, and there's going to be a lot of, well, why don't we just wait it out and see how it goes? Because people's jobs in the higher levels of the economy, in the higher levels of the military, in the higher levels of the diplomatic service, have all been built around integration with the United States. That's what their expertise is in. And so you're asking them to do a different task than they've spent their whole lives doing. But the other thing is, I think we actually have a very good way of thinking systematically, right? I actually think that's a Canadian strength. We do logistics and systems pretty well, and we do systematic changes pretty well. I mean, the old joke, like, how do you get 10 Canadians out of a swimming pool?
How?
Say, hey, guys, can you get out of the pool? Like, there's actually a certain kind of, like, collective spirit here that's actually quite useful at this moment. Now, can Carney harness it? He's not a natural politician. I don't think he's the kind of person to inspire big feelings in people. I mean, I think he is riding a wave right now, but I don't think he can create that wave. Will the Liberal Party realize that its previous existence has to be changed? This is a very hard question.
I can answer that one, too.
Yeah.
I'm
worried about that. I don't think that's cynicism. But then how much will he have to respond to that?
The inertia has already set in. It's demonstrable.
Been a day. We're talking the day after. How can you say the inertia has set in? We have to give some more time here.
The Canadian impulse and desire for things to just go back to normal is strong, my man.
But when they're woken up, I mean, look at the news. Everybody is becoming aware. Anybody who is on any form of mass media is becoming aware that the old normal is gone. They're arresting priests. They're arresting, they're deporting children with cancer. Like, they really have gone off the rails.
I'll tell you what's happened. I watch the news for my job, and what I've noticed is this. First of all, it hit a decisive turning point when the threats were at their most acute.
Yeah.
And Carney took over, and that's when the polls shifted.
Sure, overnight.
Historically, yeah. The game was completely changed overnight.
Yeah.
And then, as things always do in Canada, it starts to return, and Carney's support peaked, and Poilievre's reversal hit its basement, and they started to come closer and closer together. And if this election had been held a month later, it seems very likely to me that Poilievre would have won. And I can see in...
That's ifs and ands were pots and pans. I mean, they're being worked for tinkers.
And I can see in news traffic that to get Canadians to care about Canada happens once in a blue moon, and they only have enough... They can't sustain it. Right? For a lot of people, well, let's at least play with this idea, because I'm seeing it play out in the metrics, and maybe it's like oscillating and it'll even out to something more of a permanent crisis or an ongoing crisis. But already what I'm seeing is a sense reflected in numbers that people got alert, paid attention,
mm-hmm.
changed their mind about something very big, and then said, okay, that's settled. And now I can go back to looking at other things.
Now,
And Canadians' focus on Canada is already easing up.
No, no. Don't think
Canadians
you have any evidence for this.
Now what do we have to do?
Well, that is the
There's
question.
There's no conversation about what we have to
now,
do next.
Now, there you're right. That is the conversation we need to have. You know, the article that I wrote the next Civil War on was 2018. Like, I think the decline of the American institutions has been underway for a long time. And I think we should have been more ready for it. We should have been more prepared for it. But, you know, when you talk about, like, you know, Canadians, they're going to go back to the thing. I don't think they're going to have a chance. I mean, I think what you're...
So what does that look like? So aside from, like, sending our children into boot camp, what are you actually talking about?
Well, the interprovincial trade barriers. I mean, let's just remember... Like, they've been trying to do that since our grandparents' time. That's basically happened. I feel relatively confident that the pipeline to Hudson Bay and to BC is going to be built, right? And we're going to be exporting crude to China.
Yeah, well, we'll build some bases or get some more rangers up north.
So that's very important.
That's great. The interprovincial trade barriers, there'll be more trade alliances with other countries. We know about the platform.
So you're already talking, those are three... massive changes that have not been possible in this country for multiple generations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They've already happened.
Yeah, and it's silly that we can't do these things because they were always good ideas.
Yes.
But we need to be threatened to do them. But okay, we're doing them. But you brought up on a national level.
Yeah.
And on a personal level, like Canadians as citizens contributing to inuring ourselves to the certain chaos to come. And overcoming inertia and a desire for life just to go back to normal.
Yes.
So what does that actually mean?
Well, I would say there's a whole range of questions that we have to ask ourselves. But more importantly, I think there's this real frame shift that is going to be key, which is that I don't think we've ever had a Canadian rail politique. I don't think we've ever had a real question of what are our national interests raw and naked.
Maybe the world wars.
No, because then we're just with Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Winston Churchill makes the decisions.
Right.
We go with him.
Right.
Right. That's World War II, right? That's Afghanistan. We're with the Americans,
mm-hmm.
right? That's not an option anymore. Now is the time where we actually need a rail politique. And so, you know, I think Canadians are going to be forced to look at this stuff because there literally is no other option. Because apparently, like, you can sign a contract in 2018 and then it's meaningless 6 years later. We literally cannot have our trade based on that.
Just for clarity for our listeners, you're referring to USMCA or whatever it's called, the US-Mexico, the one that Trump negotiated in his first term with Canada with Chrystia Freeland.
Yeah, we need more reliable, harder-headed realities than that to have businesses that exist in this country, right? And so the questions are going to be forced on us. And not only that, they're going to be very ugly questions, right? They're not going to be the moralism and the how can Canada look to the world? How can Canada inspire the world with its virtue?
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to be the questions that we're going to be able to ask anymore.
Is this more the question that Stephen Harper was posing or asserting that we should be prepared to take any level of impoverishment or sacrifice?
Any level of damage was his quote.
Any level of damage.
Any level of damage. I firmly believe that. I mean, Stephen Harper is absolutely right about that. The real point is let's not get to a place that we have any damage, because there are things that we know about authoritarian societies, right? Like authoritarian societies, you cannot make, there's no point making a contract with an authoritarian. It's meaningless to them. You have to make it painful for them to screw you. Right. And that's what we need to focus on. Like, how do we actually make it painful for someone to f*** with us, and not just America?
Can you answer that question?
Well, that's why I think conscription, whole society defense. Whole society defense is the answer that Finland has come up with.
You sound like a bit of a nut.
I think you're going to see these ideas go.